Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Omaha Bar Association Bar Talk Chat. I'm Dave Summers, Executive Director of the Omaha Bar Association, here in the Bob Q Tech computer room, Sounds Computers, of the Creighton Law Library. I'm here with three attorneys from Nebraska Legal Group, David Crum, Megan Spomer, and Greg Lake. And we are going to discuss settlement facilitation. Did I get that right? Settlement facilitation.
That's it.
Before we start, I need to talk about the club that we formed, the Hannah Summers Fan Club. I'm the chair, obviously, but yeah, awesome person, right?
Absolutely.
And you'll have a podcast with her every week, I would assume.
She is all the genius and none of the dumb behind everything we do at the Omaha Bar Association. So she's not here right now, but I know you guys through her and everything like that. So I'm glad that.
She's a much harder worker than we are, which is why we can be here.
She's busy right now.
She's working. Yeah. So we're here to talk about settlement facilitation. But before we do that, again, another intro here. We need to talk about you guys. David, you are the enigma that everybody wants to know about. So let's start with you.
I better not say.
Give us your background. Give us your story.
Yeah. So I actually grew up in Nebraska. I went to school here. I went to Creighton Prep, and not that it's something that's a big deal, but I did start as a junior on the high school football team that was voted number one high school football team of all time.
That's right.
In Nebraska. So we can do another podcast on that. Anyway, so I went away from school. Yeah, I went away for school, but I thought that I would always come back and do something. So it's been what, five years?
Almost six.
About 6 years ago, after starting a practice in New Mexico and growing that, I decided I wanted to do that again. So I came back here and about almost 6 years ago, and we just started kind of from scratch. And we've had a lot of success. We have 11 attorneys here now. We practice exclusively in divorce and family law, although we are starting to do some criminal work, and we'll start doing some immigration work. But I mean, this is such a fantastic place to have a firm because of the work ethic, two great law schools in the state. And so, I mean, we've just kind of been going forward, not looking back, and we haven't lost anyone really since we started. So
what got you into
law? It's been a good ride. Just after law school, I started my own practice at 26. And so, as a lot of attorneys do, I was doing everything. You know, I had some employment law, bankruptcy, and all that. And I just ultimately gravitated to this because I liked the dynamic of it. There's a lot of client contact, and it's one of those areas of law where you can actually come into the case and immediately make an impact. It's not like another case that goes on, and maybe you can do something. You can literally come in, change people's, you know, attitudes about what's going on, change the tenor and the scope of the case. And so for me, that's always been really rewarding.
Yeah. Megan, let's hear a little bit about your story.
I'm Omaha born and raised. I did a short stint in Lawrence, Kansas for my undergraduate education. Rock chalk. and then I went to University of Nebraska Lincoln for law school, and I graduated in 2012. Started my career in child support enforcement, was there for a little over 4 years, and then went to Marks Claire and Richards, now Gross Welch Marks Claire, I believe. And about 5.5 years ago, maybe closer to six, I joined Nebraska Legal Group, and it's just been a trip to the moon.
And we talked a little bit before we hit record. You chose family law going in. When you were in law school, you said, I want to do family law.
I did. I decided I wanted to do family law in undergraduate. I had a choice about somewhere in my junior year where I was either going to start down a path to grad school to become a therapist, or I was going to start preparing to go to law school. And it turns out I am not much of a therapist. I wasn't really attracted to the research side of grad school, and law school has always been, you know, a goal of mine. And so I made that decision really early on. My second year of law school, I started the Nebraska Family Law Organization because there was no support for students who wanted to become family law attorneys. So it's kind of been the redheaded stepchild of the law. And so I wanted to bring in professionals to the law college so that students could learn about how they could go into that field. And it was very selfish because I just wanted to meet people who could help me in that career path. And then it's still an organization at the Law College today. They bring in professionals to connect students with job prospects and educational opportunities, and something I'm really proud of.
I'm a sucker for a good organization, obviously. That's great. I mean, do you have any sense of what are the numbers on attorneys that do family law as a primary part of their practice in the state? I mean, or maybe just even in the Omaha metro area, it's a large number to not have an organization that really supports that. Seems strange, but I'm glad there is now.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, right? With the practice area that takes up anywhere on a given year from 40 to 60% of the cases in the state. There are plenty of attorneys dedicated to this, and it was remarkable to me that there wasn't the support there to recruit students to, you know, learn and grow in that field from the beginning.
And it's litigation right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. Time in the courtroom, all the stuff that you want a good attorney to have experience in. Right? Mm-hmm. Definitely. So Greg Lake, you are a person of many talents. Let's get your story
here. Sure. Well, I am also born and raised in, at the time, Elkhorn, now Omaha. Went to high school at Westside High. Went to University of Nebraska, Omaha to get my undergrad. And then I wanted to go see the rest of the country, went to the University of New Hampshire Law School. And when I was done there, actually my last semester of law school, I came back and did an externship for the Nebraska Attorney General. And then graduated and started my career here. I also joined Nebraska Legal Group in 2017, right after we had started. The first two or three attorneys were already there. And so then I started and have been there ever since, and really excited. And it's just an excellent firm and great practice area, as we've already said. But I love it.
And you came from, you did some collections work for a couple of years, right?
I did. Yeah. Before NLG, I was at Brumbaugh and Quandall. That another area of the law, we're getting a lot of courtroom experience.
Oh, yeah.
Tuesday and Thursday, I was in county court. And then almost every Friday, I was down in Lancaster County Court. So that made it an easy transition, I guess, at least from the courtroom experience and being comfortable in the courtroom, in front of the judges, to be in family law arena.
And I mean, generally speaking, before we get into settlement facilitation, which I'm going to keep on trying not to fumble over as I talk, but in general, there's been a rise in family law firms in Omaha, you know, from being, like you said, the redheaded stepchild, right? But it's become a thing that there's firms that do primarily family law, and they're getting bigger and bigger. Dave, what do you think that's from? Why is that happening?
Well, I think the market has changed quite a bit. And so what you used to see, and I think especially in Omaha, was just that divorce and family law would be a component of what the firm did. Yeah. And I think people started to realize over time that you really needed to specialize in this area. It's a very complex area. And so if your firm is not set up 100%, you know, to manage that, we see people having a lot of problems. And so now in Omaha, you're seeing a lot of firms that are like we are, just exclusively divorce and family law. And you realize that it's just much better for your practice. It's more profitable. It's more efficient. It's better for you. It's better for the clients. So I would expect that that's going to continue over time.
Better than dabbling is having somebody who does this primarily, right? They have more experience. They can handle it better.
Well, as all the attorneys know, you can read the rules, but that's not how the rule is going to work. So if you're not in court all the time, understanding how judges are looking at these issues, it's really hard for someone to come in who's in another practice area and just pick up one or two or three divorce cases. It's pretty disastrous, actually.
Yeah, and you know, there's different perspectives on how to be a lawyer in family law cases, and some people take the you know, brass knuckles approach, right? Fight everything. Some people, you talk about facilitation of settlement, but quick to settle the case. Some people are all about the emotions of it. So there's a lot of different ways to practice family law, and you see that around town. There are different, ways of practicing. What do you guys hang your head on in terms of how you practice? And you probably all have your own, techniques?
So we do have our own techniques, but we have a unifying concept. And that is the case that goes to trial should be the exception. You know, we live in a metropolitan area that happens to have a lot of high net worth families, but the vast majority of cases are kind of your typical family. They have a house, they have a couple cars, they've got 401ks, and they've got some, you know, some debt, right? It's not the kind of case that you need to spend $30,000 or $40,000 on to get done. In fact, if you find yourself in that situation, something's gone awry. You know, most cases you can look at, you can evaluate, you can understand the family dynamics pretty early on in the case. And if you have the right attorneys on that case, that conversation should be happening pretty early on. And you should have an understanding of whether the case is going to be resolvable or not. And it shouldn't come down to the attorney on the other side. But a lot of the times it really does. And so our philosophy as a group is to not be the attorney that is the problem. To start from a footing of conciliation and resolution. And I'm sorry, my voice is problematic today.
It's a perfect podcast voice.
So. Yeah. That raspy.
Very sultry. Yeah.
But not being the problem, you know, and evaluating yourself constantly to make sure that you're not the problem.
Yeah. And I would say the exact same thing. And I unfortunately have too many trials. And I'm not afraid to go to trial. We will, if it has to go, it has to go. But, you know, I can just think of an example recently where these two clients spent $70,000 in attorney's fees between them to equalize the marital property to the tune of $58,000 in a qualified domestic relations order, which means that I mean, $58,000 is coming out of 401k. It's not really $58,000, especially with the tax implications. If they take it out now, I don't know why that case went to trial.
Yeah. Well, and that brings us to why we're here today, not just to have this lovely color coordinated people in front of
us. But you change our logo after this.
It's a softer red. It's red adjacent. To talk about settlement facilitation, which, you know, David, you and I share a Nebraska background. Greg, you spent some time working for David before you went to law school, right? Yeah. So you have that New Mexico connection as well. But down in the desert, what happened down there, and what are you trying to bring up?
Down in the desert. Wow, this is a really dramatic question. I think you said we have a Nebraska link. We have a New Mexico link, right? Because you went to
New Mexico.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, it's not just New Mexico. I mean, I should back up a little bit from my intro and just say that where things got, you know, pretty crazy for me was after opening this practice, we opened another practice in Colorado. So we have three active practices with 32 divorce attorneys that I sort of lead. And after that, I opened a marketing agency to provide marketing services to other divorce clients throughout the United States. So I see all these markets. I see this three markets here, California, Michigan, New York, everywhere. And, you know, when I started practicing in New Mexico, they had developed something called mandatory settlement facilitation in domestic relations cases. I didn't know that wasn't normal. And so since the very beginning of my practice, that was just an expected part of the practice. And so, you know, when we came here, we saw a lot of what Greg was talking about, that a lot of cases going to trial, a lot of cases settling on the courthouse steps, which is probably the worst disservice you can do to a client. So we started talking and saying, you know, is there a way that we might be able to talk to the judiciary about something like this? And it's not that, and I want to be very clear, this is not being critical of the judges or the community here. It's just that we'd like to explore another way to possibly do this. And so we, you know, I asked one of the judges from New Mexico, who was kind of the architect of this mandatory settlement. And she came and we both together spoke to the judiciary here in the second. And, you know, it seems like something that the community is interested in. And so it's just a better way to provide services. And it not only helps clients, but it vastly reduces judges' caseloads and trial and trial dockets. So it really is, if done correctly, just a win-win for everybody that's involved in the process.
And I mean, that's the thing, is there's no real losers in trying to settle this before you get to the courthouse steps or going to trial, right? Other than you get less gray hair as an attorney in the case.
I don't know what you're talking about.
you give the clients more of their money back and time and everything like that. I guess I'm trying to see what. Okay, so let's before we get down to what the potential hangups are, let's go through a case study here, right? Like a case, you have two kids, both parents have some money in savings, some money in retirement. They both work outside the home. The kids are 10 and 12. How do you go through settlement facilitation instead of the normal way where you just go into, potential trial?
Yeah, let these guys talk a little bit about what actually happens now without settlement, and then I'll kind of come in and say how we would take that and put it into a settlement model.
Gotcha.
I mean, now what we're doing is the case gets filed. We go to the temporary hearing, and the judge is going to make a decision about custody of the children, if any, not necessarily property issues, unless somebody's asking to be in the marital home exclusively. We're talking about child support. We're talking about potentially temporary spousal support. And that normally happens within, say, the first 30 to 60 days of a case. The feeling that I get is if someone gets a good outcome in the temporary hearing, then they just think, well, the judge is never going to change their mind. So I don't have any incentive to attempt to settle this case or attempt to tell my client, listen, that's a temporary order. Certainly the judge could change their mind, especially if the other party is doing what they're ordered to do, and there's no safety issues with the children, things like that. So, and then if we're going to settle or call a settlement conference, it's got to be one of the attorneys reaching out to the other attorney saying, can we please sit down with everyone and try and settle this?
But how often does that actually happen? That's like it's got to be less than 10% of the time, doesn't it?
Most of the time. Yeah.
And because there's a cost to hire a settlement facilitator, right? A third party. So both sides have to agree on more costs and maybe taking some of their potential ability to get the outcome that they told their client that they didn't want, that they could get to. So I guess you take the certainty of the lawyers being in control and you kind of put the clients in control a little bit more when you get to that on some level.
Which is the way it should be. Yeah. This is not our case. The outcome does not affect our lives one iota. We're not going to go home and have our lives impacted by the outcome of the case. The parties should be in control of the process. They should be in control of the outcome. Mm-hmm. And giving them the ownership of that is one of the most powerful parts of this whole idea. And yes, you kind of have a little bit of that in mediation, but the way we've gone about mediation in Nebraska is so ad hoc and it's so piecemeal that it doesn't give the parties a full opportunity to discuss all the issues in their case in a meaningful way. We like to think of property issues as separate from parenting time issues, but the fact of the matter is they aren't. The kids' lives are impacted by who gets the house. It could change where they go to school. Who has access to the retirement funds could impact whether they can afford to go to college because those funds could be used for that. So there really are a lot of overlapping issues that pertain to property and the children. And separating them out this way, I think, really challenges the parties to think about them in an unholistic way, and they don't understand the consequences of that division. So if you put everyone kind of in a situation to be able to talk about the case as a whole and understand the impact of one issue on another, it gives them all the information they need. I mean, it's informed consent, right? How do they know that they're agreeing to the best possible outcome if they don't understand the impact of one decision on another?
And I would also add, you know, the cost of it, you know, I know in New Mexico for a full day, it's $1,500.
At the most.
Typically. At the most. then the parties would split that cost. That is much more economical than going to trial and spending $50,000,
right,
throughout the life of the case.
Spent to save money.
Yeah, I mean, what's essentially happening now is after they get through, and please correct me. I mean, I'm admitted here, but because I'm not in court every day, you know, it's better to have Greg and Megan talk about it. But, you know, basically after they do these temp orders and they'll go through the discovery process, they're just sort of trading written offers back and forth. It's extremely inefficient. And then some people don't get to them. It's just not a great way to get a case resolved. So if we can talk a little bit about what it will look like instead. So you have a process that's in place. You have sort of an informal, or you can formalize a pool of people that will act as settlement facilitators. The thing that's important to understand is once this actually starts and people get used to it, the court doesn't even have to order it. The attorneys know, like, we got to get this ready for settlement. Who do we want to use? Like, they're picking their own, you know, people that they like that are good facilitators. So then at some point, there's a formal order that you go do this. And if you can't agree, the judge is just going to assign somebody. A lot of times this is done at a pretrial conference where they'll say, what's the status of the case? Are we ready to go to settlement? Yes. All right, let's go. Let's get it done within the next 30 days. There's a formal process to this. The person gets appointed as a settlement facilitator, and then the parties are required to get them what's called a settlement statement, you know, 5 days before settlement. This lays out all the facts of the case, what the legal issues are, what the proposed settlement is, how much is it going to cost to go to trial, how much attorney's fees have you already paid, and all that gets presented to the facilitator, who then schedules it. Now, the important thing here is that we settle, you know, in the high 90s, 95, 96 or more percent of these cases, because when parties get in the same room, especially the clients, they want it done. So that it's just a jump start for settlement. So you come in, you're ready to go, you schedule half a day or a full day. And then the facilitator, who's typically an experienced, you know, divorce litigator who knows kind of what these issues are, starts pushing them in the direction of settlement. And if you reach a settlement, you write it up, you know, it's either informal or you might even have the final documents if you're super cool, you know, and you've got that ready to go and, you know, and it's submitted. And then the court has to be very consistent about enforcing these. I mean, I practiced for 27 years. I have never had a court not enforce a settlement. And you have to do that so that there's confidence in there. But, There's really no downside to it. And we can talk about, you know, what the mythology is around and what kind of the reality is. But that's what it would look like. And from a cost perspective, and then I'll shut up, you know, we've seen it range from, you know, as little as $750 for half day to like $1,500, maybe a little bit more if it's complex and you've got a really high level facilitator. But I've never had a client object to that. It's like Greg said, I say, hey, $1,500, $750 to you. And it's going to save us, you know, tens and tens and tens of hours of going to trial. And no one ever objects to that. And in fact, at the end, the vast majority of people are really happy that we got into it and got the case settled.
I just wanted to point out one thing. The settlement facilitation happens after discovery is completed. Megan and I have heard some pushback from when we've been presenting this to the state bar and the family law section. Like, this is after discovery. This is after you're identifying issues. This is after you know what your case is. This isn't you just get in 30 days and try and settle the case. You are identifying issues, doing the discovery before this happens.
Yeah, and it's not uncommon at a pretrial conference to just set these realistic discovery deadlines, and then you know you're not going to do it until you're done with discovery. So it's not a rushed process, but it's way quicker than litigation for sure.
Well, and the other thing that has really been probably the most attractive part of all this is that it forces the discovery process. If you're not going to get a trial date until after settlement facilitation has been at least attempted, then you know that at least you're not filing new discovery 15 days before your trial date, or you're not getting that phone call a week before trial going, oh, I'm just now thinking about this. I'm looking at the property and, you know, it's really not that complicated. Let's work this thing out, right? It forces the attorneys to do a better job for their clients earlier in the case. Right. And this isn't every attorney, but we've all had that experience, right? With these attorneys that they either take on too many cases or they feel like they've been practicing so long that they don't really need to look at it until it gets close to trial. But the result is that you can't have meaningful settlement negotiations if you don't understand the marital estate. You know, one of the things that we impart on all of our attorneys and our support staff is that the most important thing you can do is start building your property chart immediately. You know, you start getting that information, that way you're prepared to make a quality settlement offer and you're also prepared to evaluate one if it comes in. How do you know if a settlement offer is reasonable or good for your client if you have no idea what the marital estate looks like? Yeah. And so it really forces the counsel to do their job sooner and in a meaningful way. And a lot of times that'll settle it without settlement facilitation, right? I mean, once you put numbers on paper, they are what they are.
I think there's something said where it's, you know, when you know your case frontwards and backwards, that's when it settles, right? Mm-hmm. When you are ready to go to trial, you know exactly what the ranges of what, you know, the good mm-hmm. numbers would be for the settlement or good terms of the settlement. And that's when you know this is going to be a good deal. Mm-hmm. Client, you should take this. Absolutely.
Yep.
And a good settlement facilitator, and I've done a lot of settlement facilitations as a facilitator, they can cure a lot of this stuff too, right in the mediation. You know, I've had situations where there's some lack of discovery and we'll get online and get the discovery. You know, are they bank statements? Is it a 401k statement? What do you need to see? So if you've got a good facilitator who's experienced, you know, in these cases, you can actually cure a lot of those right in the middle of settlement.
So the sticking point, or not the sticking point, but the reality of you have a trial, here's the post-trial decree from the judge on what was decided, and you have a decree that was written up by the parties through a settlement process. Is one more effective than the other? If they had their day in court, does that mean that they don't fight over it as much afterwards or anything like that? Or what do you see?
So what we've known for a long time is that stipulated decrees are followed better by parties. If they feel like they had a part in that decision, if they feel ownership over that decision, they are much more likely to follow it. It's not 100% rule, right? People break agreements all the time. But you are far more likely to have compliance with the stipulation than with an order that is crammed down your throat. Judges are also more likely to enforce a consent decree and also leave it intact when a modification comes to challenge it. So in my experience, consent decrees are more secure than ordered decrees.
That's a pretty big point right there.
Yeah.
Isn't it? You know, people coming back for modification on something small. No, you guys decided this. Mm-hmm. You had ability to write this up any way you wanted to. Now you're saying you want to change it. You can't change your mind on this, right?
Right.
And let's also think about the judges, you know, getting your day in court. If the litigants think that, I would want to dissuade them from that notion. And here's why, because we don't have dedicated family law courts in Nebraska. And so the judges in Douglas, anywhere throughout the state, Douglas, Lancaster, wherever, they could be hearing a murder trial the day before they're hearing your family law case. And you're arguing about, you know, an extra day for the kids or $20,000 in the quadro. And they might, after they're done with your trial, they might have a sexual assault case. You know, taking your chances and your day in court, I don't know that that's the best option. You certainly might not get the best outcome.
Yeah, I'd say the day in court does exactly the opposite of that. It's most people are baffled by what the judge does or very unhappy. One side is usually really unhappy, and sometimes both sides are unhappy. And so I think it's like Megan says, look, you know, a judge who's doing the best they can, it gets to learn about your family for 2, 3, 6, 7 hours. They really don't know what's best. You know what's best. You're the parents of these kids. You know what your life is going to look like. So the more voice you have in fashioning the settlement, the better that's going to play out, just as everyone said. And, you know, the more content people are going to be with where they are with that stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, back to the Hannah Summers fan club, I get to hear about all that you guys do, all family law practice. And there's a lot of stories of burnout in family law by people that practice for a long time, and they're seeing a breaking point on cases taking a very long time, very contentious. And like you were talking about in that situation, Greg, is how much money is being spent for what results, right? And this is a new level that's sort of come maybe during the pandemic, maybe that changed it, I don't know. But there is a point where we're kind of at an inflection breaking point where something needs to change, right?
Yeah, no, I'd hard agree with that. I think since coming back from remote work and having very few trials during, you know, kind of the COVID period, I have noticed a marked increase in conflict. I don't know what's causing it. I'm not going to pretend like I'm a social scientist and can diagnose it, but anecdotally, it has been much higher conflict, and not just between the parties, but between counsel, you know, and there's really no reason for it. I mean, you can have a disagreement with opposing counsel without having it turn personal or nasty, but I've noticed just an increase in that kind of behavior. And it's really challenging. It becomes really hard to settle a case when you can't even have a civil conversation with the opposing counsel. And part of it is email, you know, and not having the humanization and feeling like you read into a tone into the email that maybe isn't there, and you kind of create this unnecessary animosity. And you know what? Yesterday was a perfect example. We've been litigating this case for 18 months. It's a divorce. There's two kids. Both are fit parents. They've been on a temporary order for 50-50 for over a year, right? They're still arguing over some things in the parenting plan. Some were reasonable. Some were not. I pretty much insisted on a settlement conference that we have this. And this was an attorney I didn't have a lot of experience with. We had known each other, you know, casually, but we didn't have a close personal working relationship. And at the beginning, it was tense. You know, there was a lot of resistance to compromise. But we kept at it. We were in the room for 3.5 hours. And over that period of time, I think we all recognized each other as people. We all recognized each other as wanting what was best for the children. And we stopped assuming the worst in one another. And when we did that, the decisions came much more fluidly. You know, they had never put their financial positions next to each other. You know, we had traded them back and forth a bunch of times, but they'd never put them next to each other. And when we did that, we realized there were really only 5 numbers we disagreed on, and we were less than $44,000 apart, and they had each already spent over $30,000 on this divorce.
Yeah.
They very quickly made a decision.
I've noticed it too. I think that the pandemic did a few things. First, people are just way more stressed out. I mean, that's for sure. Like in all the interviews we do and all the performance reviews, people have a super high level of stress. Secondly, I think that we've become less of a community because When we were going to court, we all know how that works, right? You go there and you're sitting around waiting half the time and you see so-and-so and so-and-so and you're talking, hey, how are the kids? And you're much more collegial. And now we're just like, everybody's kind of behind their barrier, you know, doing their thing. And then of course, just the pace at which, you know, information is exchanged and what people's expectations are. They want it right now. You know, the law practice hasn't changed. It's just their expectations have changed a lot. And so, again, for us, I think this is one of those things that sort of helps balance your practice. You know, if you getting ready for a settlement and going through settlement where half the time, you know, you might be just sitting with your client waiting while there's a caucus, it's so much less stressful for the attorneys and for the clients. And, you know, so we do see it as a possible way of kind of lowering that stress and encouraging more collegiality, because at the end of the day, the court relies on attorneys to push the cases forward. And I think people forget that's a, you know, a primary part of your job.
There's a frustration on the bench, right now when it comes to how much time is being spent. The volume, certainly, of trials and hearings and motions on family law and wanting it to be less than it is. I always talk about this crazy thing where you get a trial and it's you're talking property, you're talking maybe alimony and child custody and support. It's going to be maybe 2 days. Those days aren't going to necessarily be together.
Nope.
Like this crazy.
Yeah.
You're going to have one month and 1 2 weeks later, a month later, like these trials that aren't actually.
There is no worse scenario.
Oh.
there is no worse scenario. The clients, I think, don't always understand that when we have to break a trial up like that, they focus on that the whole time. We have several other cases and several other trials that we have to do in between that period of time, which means we're basically starting over on trial prep the second time. It is so much more expensive to do it that way.
I'm sorry. That's something that we actually haven't been talking about. We're all assuming that this is a straight through trial, which it never is. And so everybody loses sight of the fact that, and sometimes it's like 6 months, right? Mm-hmm. It can be a long time. And then the clients don't realize we've got to prep everything again. You've got to be re-prepped to testify because we haven't prepped for 6 months.
And
so it's actually even more expensive in this is true in most states than a trial normally is.
Mm-hmm. And let me just give an example. I had a case. I called a settlement conference with opposing counsel. Opposing counsel showed up with their client and was there for 15 minutes and said, "We're not getting anything done. See you later." Go to trial. Trial starts in January. Don't get done in one day. Judge's next primary trial date was August. 7 months down the road, we agreed to get a backup trial date in May. That's 4 months down there. And the judge doesn't remember.
When you filled in for the backup?
A week before we're supposed to call and see if we can get, we're going to be on that May date.
And again, it's not a criticism of the judiciary, but that's the reality of what's happening because there's so many damn cases. The other thing that people forget about is the vast majority of these cases are pro se. Attorneys don't think about that because they're not there when those cases are happening. So, the courts are really clogged up with that stuff. And so it'd be really nice if the attorneys could help lessen the burden on the courts so that they could only hear the things that really needed to be heard on the private side.
Yeah. And that is not a criticism of the judiciary at all. It's the judges' calendars are full.
Yeah.
They are full. And if I'm correct, they've got the criminal jury trials where they have to have 2 weeks set out.
Right.
And, they can't schedule over that.
Mm-hmm.
Not their fault at all. Yeah. And so their schedules are tight. Why are we waiting around for a year to get a trial date? And then, if you don't get it done, you're waiting another nearly year to get another second trial date.
I think there's a larger conversation to be had maybe about potentially going back to a family law judge or two or three or five.
Oh boy, you're going to get some.
That's a whole nother podcast.
You're going to get some feedback. You're going to get some feedback.
That's a whole nother podcast.
Chief, you did not hear me.
Let me say this. This is not a criticism, but a caution to the judiciary. If this is going to work, if we are going, if we can help us help you.
Jerry Maguire.
Right? Help me help you.
Help me help you, help you, help me.
When you order these, enforce them.
Yeah.
That's something I have been really frustrated with over the course of my practice. We get these orders from the court and then someone violates the order and there's virtually no consequence. There's no fees ordered when we bring it to the court's attention. There is nothing but delay and capitulation to the bad behavior. And this isn't all judges, but it is a lot. And if we're going to see a change in the bad behavior, the orders have to be enforced. And I would expect it to be enforced against me the same as it would be enforced against anybody. If my client's being a problem, I'm getting out of the case before I'm going to let our reputation be ruined by that. But at the same time, they have to be enforced or this isn't going to work.
I've heard David say, and I think that it rings true to me, and I hope that it starts ringing true to everyone in the community. It should be really hard to fight mm-hmm. in these cases. And the courts, the judiciary's role in that is saying, I'm not gonna hear this until you go to settlement facilitation or until you go to mediation or until you've picked up the phone and talked to the other attorney.
Yeah.
It should just be really hard to fight, in my opinion.
Without getting too far off track, because I do want to talk about this, Dave, and you'll probably get in big trouble for this. But I mean, there is a lot of wisdom in looking at a family and divorce court. And let's see. So New Mexico is fairly similar to the size of this community. And I think they have three or four. And then they have special masters that support and hear a lot of stuff underneath them. And the reason why that is a better model, number one, I hope that my experience has been that there's been judges that they're really interested in this, like they like it. And so those judges gravitate toward those positions. Let's face it, you know, like, hey, I don't blame anybody. Like, there are a lot of judges that just don't want to deal with this. It just doesn't seem as important as somebody's murder trial, right? And I get that, and that's true. And so if you've got a set of judges, what it does is it provides us, all the attorneys, with a lot more predictability. Because now you've got four people that you're in front of all the time. And you're like, oh, this judge never gives alimony, or this judge is going to do this. And it helps to settle the case. We've got how many judges in the second here?
In the 18? Fourth, we have 18.
Are we the fourth?
We're the fourth.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fourth. So 18 judges. So the predictability across that, it's just very difficult. And you know, I know this isn't necessarily a popular idea, but it's been super, I've seen it be super effective.
Well, I think there's big conversations across the board. So apparently we're merit selection here in Nebraska, right? We think that there is ways to improve that, but then you talk to Pennsylvania and their judges are elected and they're at each other's throats. They're not showing up to any bar association stuff. Mm-hmm. They're not talking to each other. They're not talking to, you know, the attorneys. Mm-hmm. They're holed up in their corner and it's all political, you know, animosity. Mm-hmm. And, but even here, you know, you get selected because you have this great background in criminal law. And you can do those cases, and that's super important to get those right. And when those aren't done correctly, then the judiciary gets besmirched. And so that's an important key. But then when you have 40-60% of your caseload being family law, boy, no background in family law, that's a tough situation.
And we see that all the time. So what you see in Nebraska, and again, not a criticism, it makes total sense on what the governor is doing. But it's, you know, they're picking a lot of people with prosecution backgrounds, which is great because there's such a big number of criminal cases. But, you know, when you've got a family court and then that position comes open, they're appointing people with deep experience in divorce and family law. And you would be amazed what those kind of people come in and how they run their dockets based on their own experience with how cases are handled. And so it's like night and day when you're in front of.
Yeah. And the only other point I want to make on that is I think we made a big mistake a long, long time ago when we decided that family law cases are adversarial in nature, when we decided families are enemies and that they need to fight one another. And just starting from that mental perspective injects so much conflict that doesn't need to be there. And I think over time, our goal as a practice should be to transform the approach of family law from that of an adversarial approach to a collective approach, because these are together or not, they have children, they're a family, and they're going to have to figure out how to live that life going forward. And if your kids are 5, 6, 7 years old, you got a long time, you know, to work through that. And you have to decide really early on, are you going to be enemies or are you going to be co-parents? Are you going to be partners in this process?
And that's not to say that we just give everybody what they want, or there are not cases where you're gonna butt heads and maybe in a very aggressive way, but it can still be civil. Mm-hmm. You know, you still get to the point where everyone knows why are we doing this? I think a large majority of these cases, the client doesn't even know why they're going to trial. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, please don't confuse this with, you know, that somehow this is, you know, the results are gonna be different. If you can't agree, then you're going to have a trial. Mm-hmm. And if you got to fight, then you do sometimes have to fight. We just don't like coming out of the box, you know, mm-hmm. starting it that way. It sets the tone for some really bad stuff. And it's not just till your kids are 18, guys. It's till it's for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
I see people with 40-year-old, 50-year-old kids, and they still have problems because of the divorce that happened 30 years ago.
And let's take a step to talk about just the process. So this was rolled out and presented, and now it's being used in some courts. So can you guys talk a bit about where that's all at?
Yeah, these guys are, yeah.
I know that Sarpy County is, I'm not sure that all of the judges are using it there, but I know that two of them in their pretrial orders, you are ordered to mediate you're ordered to mediate property issues along with the parenting plan. And they're enforcing that. They will not give you a trial date until you have that done. Douglas County, I know that Judge Engelman has in his pretrial order that you have to attempt to facilitate your property issues. I think that there are some others who are on board. I don't know the exact number, but we're very hopeful that this is gaining some steam, and all of the judges would at least consider ordering some sort of settlement facilitation before allowing the people to come in and have a trial.
And for attorneys out there, the difference between parenting plan mediation and property mediation is actually really important, because you need an attorney to mediate or draft up an agreement with respect to property, and that's not a requirement for parenting plans. Mm. And so using a facilitator to do it all, it can be a cost savings to your client. So they're not going to one mediator for the parenting plan and a settlement facilitator for the property, because a non-attorney mediator really can't help the parties with the property issues.
Yeah. And I do want to make it clear, it's not like our firm is directing or has control of this or anything like that. We're really, like, part of this podcast, the purpose of it is to have a dialogue started in the divorce community. And even with the judiciary, we can just get together and talk some more about how this might, you know, I know that there's sometimes a tendency when a small group of lawyers want to implement something, there's resistance to it. What's in it for them? Why are they doing this? And, you know, it's in it for, we're in it all together. So anybody that sees this, if they want to reach out to any of us, and start moving this thing forward. See, the thing is too, is let's be clear. You don't need the judges to do this.
Right.
You don't need them to. You can do it yourself. And there are plenty of really good attorneys in this town that could facilitate cases. And if you want to facilitate a case, like, we're absolutely on it. And I think we're forming a group of people that are interested in the community that want to be facilitators and that will just start doing it on their own.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. It's great to have judges saying that you need to do this, but your lawyer can make this happen too, saying we're going to do a negotiated settlement, facilitation here. Hopefully we can make it work. So you want to ask your attorney on the way in, or potential attorney, are you on board with doing this, this process? You know, the clients themselves can understand coming in. I don't want to go to trial if I can avoid it. I want to save money. I want to try this process. So empowering them. So we have all these three different approaches, right?
Right.
Of trying to get to the same thing and diversifying it. And it's not to the benefit necessarily of you all. You just want a better, easier, more efficient system, right?
Like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we can't facilitate our own cases.
Right.
So, and because we're an exclusively family law firm, I mean, we need others in the community to learn how to do this and want to do this and be good at it. And so, this really is aimed at making this better for all of us. I don't want to burn out. I love what I do.
Yeah.
I want to do it for a long time. But if I have to keep going to trial multiple times a month, I'm not going to make it to 50 doing this. And I want to. And so we've just got to find a better way.
And there are people, you know, if you asked a person, what do you think the best way to end your relationship and have healthy relationship with your ex, would it be reaching a mutual, you know, beneficial agreement together? Or would it be, let's go ahead and start our post-divorce relationship by getting on the stand under oath and just saying the nastiest things we can think about?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a recipe for disaster. And I think if you did the research, I would bet you that people who litigate their divorces have a lot more difficulty communicating than the ones who settle their cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We've been going so serious for so long here, but I gotta ask. So you were at the Duluth UNO hockey game? Megan Spomer, season ticket holder, UNO hockey. Were you at the Duluth?
I was not, because I was sick.
Greg
was there. My husband, Sam, who used to be the director of operations for UNO hockey, was actually doing color commentary that night. So I was glued to it. I was watching it. And it was a hell of a weekend. It was fantastic.
Director of operations, is he the guy who's setting up the shot on the ice for the, you know, $200 gift card, or what's it?
What's the director of operations do? So he's not now.
That's not the hype guy. I'm not.
He's not the hype guy. Okay, no. He anything that wasn't an on-ice coaching duty was his responsibility.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. He coordinated all of their travel. He would coordinate recruitment visits. Yeah. He worked with the coaches to develop kind of team strategy and culture and those sorts of things. And he did that for about 6 years, but he's been out of that for the last four.
And he doesn't have a mullet.
Not anymore.
All right. You got to win the job.
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore.
Did I see you have a mullet back in the day? No.
I wouldn't say a mullet, no.
There wasn't a picture of you a bodybuilding pose with a mullet?
Just think about more like Patrick Swayze hair from the 80s. It's kind of like that.
Feathered. Okay.
No comment.
So this practice, we'll wrap it up with, you guys are in a very dynamic, interesting, emotional-filled practice, and you got stories that nobody will believe, right? Like, this is not a boring area, and part of the reason you guys care and it's shown up today is because you care. But also, there's just really a lot of entertainment. And I got to ask, any war story, any funny story you want to throw out here for the good of the order? And you won't believe this happening.
I've got two. There was a woman was seeking a protection order. In her protection order, the basis of her protection order was she thought that her ex-husband was going to file a contempt action against her, and he had a very good lawyer who was me, yeah. And so she needed a protection order.
is that a thing?
That's
wow. And the results?
The results, the judge just did not grant the protection order, dismissed it immediately.
And protection order is something that I want to do a town hall on, because I think we need to understand protection orders better. We also need to understand when potentially they're a bit of a tool abused, yeah, in the family law system.
Definitely.
But talk about the good of it. There's, yeah, a lot of good. There's a lot of need. But also, watch out. Let's not go over the line.
That'd be a great town hall.
Yeah.
Megan, you got a case for us here?
Oh, goodness.
A story?
So all my best stories are from when I worked for child support enforcement. None of my private practice stories even pale in comparison. And my favorite child support story was early in my career there, my first year or two. And my job there was to enforce these orders. And so we'd have days-long contempt cattle calls where there would be 50 or 60 people out in the hallway. And we just go through them, and there's a public defender on the other side. And sometimes the custodial parent would come. And in this case, it was the mother. And she represented herself. I represented the state. And I said, okay, the money's owed to you. It's not owed to me. So, how do you want to proceed here today? And she was like, if he would take a bath with me, I'll waive all the money that's owed. And it was like almost $30,000. That he owed her in back child support. And I said, okay, let me go get the public defender, because I don't represent you. I can't negotiate on your behalf, but let me bring her in here.
Was it a bubble bath or just a regular?
I didn't ask. So public defender comes in, and I said, tell her what you just told me. She said, if he'll take a bath with me, I will waive the $30,000 that he owes me. She goes, I'll be right back. And I follow her out, and I leave this woman in the room. I said, what are you going to do? She goes, I'm going to tell him to take the bath.
Oh my God. Is it put a subject matter jurisdiction over that? I don't.
She's like, I'm going to tell him to take the bath. And I said,
is that prostitution?
I was like, I'm okay. You do you. She comes back and she says, he won't do it. He went to jail for 30 days.
For the refusing to take a bath.
So, okay, and that's, yeah, you get to the point when you actually go to jail for not paying child support.
Right. Yeah. So he was ordered to pay. He couldn't pay. He was in a tough situation. But his sentence was 30 days on the contempt, and he preferred 30 days in county lockup.
Do they have baths? Do you have to take a bath with somebody else?
Maybe she just hogged up the bath.
Right?
It's
chose one bath.
I was like, I don't know. This must be a really interesting woman for him to pass on a $30,000 deal.
Wow, that is quite the story, Dave.
Let's
David,
see. I find amusing the stories that really highlight the difference between how men look at things and women in these cases. So my case was, client was married and had a vasectomy during the marriage. He decides it's a good idea to go out and have an affair, which is, you know, a lot of people do that. But he also decides to have an affair with a really crazy person, and he reversed his vasectomy and got her pregnant. And so we file the case, or his wife files the case, and I get him into settlement, you know, and he wanted it settled today. Like he wanted it settled yesterday. So we're sitting there and it's just going nowhere. And he turns to me and he goes, "Why is she so mad?" And I just said, "Well, if you want to settle it today, you're going to have to pay a lot of money." So that was one case that was not good for settlement facilitation. Early, she needed to kind of vent and just get it squared away. But yeah, just completely clueless.
You got to laugh at some of the stuff that you deal with, and it's not minimizing it. It's just wow.
It's gallows humor.
Real life.
Yep. And people are just in the, you know, they're not themselves. They're often the worst kind of mental state they've been in, you know, maybe their whole life. And so we kind of take that into consideration and try not to get too excited about what they do. But
yeah. Well, those are all my questions. Did I miss anything? Is there anything else you guys want to add? David Crum, the myth, a legend here, you know. God. We got all of Omaha and Nebraska watching, and they want to know everything about you. So if you can just either continue the myth in some way by saying something really cryptic, or, you know, no, I kid, because obviously you're a real person. It's just one of those things that in this town, they're like, David Crum.
No, it's fun. It's just, it's fun to be back. And, you know, I've really enjoyed it here. I mean, this is, God, I don't want to give these guys a big head, but I mean, this is the highest performing team we have out of the three firms. So it's always a pleasure to be with these guys and to be with you too. So thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, and we'll adjourn the Hannah Summers fan club, along with this podcast. All right. Thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dave.